You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. I know, it's cheesy Apocalypse Now music, so with apologies. We continue. My thanks to Justin Constantine for coming on. This hour of All Marine Radio is sponsored by Battle Mug, home of the badass Battle Mug. Right? Starts as 13.5 pounds of solid block T6 aluminum. Right? It's milled, machined, and anodized into a battle mug. Picatinny rails, laser rage finders, binoculars, LED lights, cameras, all that can go on your mug if you're a hunter or a sportsman. You could decorate it if it sits in your office. It's a great gift for farewells, promotions, retirements, and other special occasions. You'll find it at battlemug.com. You can go check it out on our website, and there's pictures of it up there. And enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. So it's a great deal. Anyway, with all that said, we come to Ken Rogers. He of Boise, Idaho fame. First of all, Ken, thanks for taking time out here on a Monday and joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure.
The first time I had you on, we talked about your documentary, and then I watched it, and I was blown away by it. Now I get this thing in the mail. Ken sends me a copy, and he says, "Hey, when you watch it, make sure you have a good sound system and you turn it up." So I said, okay. And so I want to talk to you about making it. I want to talk to you about the consideration of, because one of the things that I'm going to walk you through things that I saw and you tell me about it. Okay. So we'll do a little thumbnail bio for people who haven't met you yet. And, Ken, born and raised where?
Casa Grande, Arizona.
We've talked about this before, but the Giants trained there and, for baseball, the San Francisco Giants trained there for baseball. And, why the Marine Corps? How did that get on your radar? And how old were you when you joined?
Well, it's been a while, so the story changes, I think, of why, we were all, had the draft back then, and it was always looming over your head. And I joined the Marine Corps before they had the lottery system, so I think your chances were a lot better of getting drafted if you didn't have friends on the local draft board. I was in college at Arizona State University, but I was not real hip about going to school. I wanted to drink beer and chase girls and do stuff like that, and
which is admirable.
Sure, it was. That's what you're supposed to do, I think.
Exactly.
Anyway,
so,
that was looming over me, and I was working that summer on a core drilling for a core drilling company that was doing core drilling for copper on the Indian Reservation south of where I live, which is at the time we called it the Papago Indian Reservation, but now they call it the Tohono O'odham, and it's a huge reservation, and we were down there drilling for to see what the copper content of the ground was there. And I knew I wasn't going to do that, and I had a friend that lived across the street that got his draft notice, so he wanted to go to Phoenix and join up with something, but he had lost his driver's license, so he came across the street, and I was home, and he said, "Take me to Phoenix." So I drove him up there, and we went to the Coast Guard first, but it was a 2-year waiting list. And so we then went over to the Army, and he talked to them about becoming a chopper pilot, which eventually he did. And then we went down to see the Navy, and the Navy and the Marine Corps were in the same building. And when he went in to talk to the Navy, I walked across the hall and went in and joined up. Kind of spur of the moment. Why? Probably just felt that it was going to come one way or the other. And, I had two uncles and three cousins that were in the Marine Corps. Two uncles in World War II. One of them who was with Brit Krulak. And they were good buddies after the war, which I could never understand when I was in the Marine Corps. I used to be buddies with a guy who was a general, but now I understand. I had a cousin who was killed in Chosin Reservoir. And, you know, so it was just, and my dad hated Marines, so that was a good reason, right?
Well, you got the whole thing going there. Wow.
Yeah. So I joined up, and you couldn't get in to boot camp because they were too busy. So I sat around for a couple of months. I joined on October the 4th, 1966, and then I went in on October the 4th. August the 4th is when I joined. October the 4th is when I went in, and I'd been in there about 20 seconds, and I decided I did not like that. But, of course, you're too late then. So.
Exactly. So now what? Hey, now what, genius?
Right, right. You know, I don't like people yelling at me, man. And that was, you know, the worst place to be for somebody like me. So.
You might have thought about that before you did it there. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. So you joined the Marine Corps. Now, what year is that, and how old are you?
Well, I was 19. I joined in 66. And I went to Vietnam, and I got there, I think, on the March 27th of 67. Flew into Da Nang on Continental Airlines in the middle of the night. Sat around the transit barracks there until sometime in mid-morning, and with a couple of other guys that I'd gone through staging battalion with, and truck came and picked us up and took us out into the southwest of Da Nang, about 20 miles, I think, to a place called Hill 55, which is where the 26th Marines were. So then I went there, and we were in that vicinity for about a month fighting Viet Cong, if we ever saw them. I didn't see any. I may have seen a couple, but, they were farmers, the farmers around there.
Right.
And then the hill fights were going on up in Quezon, so we went up there. And I was there for the rest of my time. So.
All right. So there you have a little synopsis. Now, one of the interesting things I wanted to talk about relative to your experiences. You said you were 19 when you joined. So how old were you? What are you, 20, 21?
I'd been 21 10 days when the siege started. I was old guy. I mean, I was old.
That blew me away watching, and Ken's documentary is called Bravo! Common Men, Uncommon Valor. And it's about Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Marine Regiment. What blows me away is, as in the first part of it, you're introducing everybody. And they're all young guys. They're 17- and 18-year-old guys when they join the Marine Corps, and then they're in Quezon.
All except for the corpsman, John Scala. He was a little older than I am. Still is. He's still with us. And then the officers, and although we had officers there at the siege that I think were younger than I was. So we were a young bunch, man. So the
leaders of this organization are all under the age of 25.
Well, the skipper was, I think he was probably about 29.
All right. So the company commander is 29. Everybody else, younger than 25, yes?
Yeah.
And a lot of them, you know, younger than 20, yes?
Oh, yeah. Most of those guys in there were, when all of this was going on, were 18. We had a couple of 20-year-old lieutenants that joined the Marine Corps when they were 18, and they were gung-ho and, you know, went to OCS and a basic school and came over there, and they didn't have too good an experience. So you know, my platoon commander was had gotten his master's degree from St. Bonaventure. He may have been 24, 25. You know, the staff NCOs were, of course, old men, we thought, at the time. You know, the gunny was right. Probably 15 years in, and our platoon sergeant was a guy named Alvarado who went on to become a sergeant major, I believe, and he at one time was the youngest staff sergeant in the Marine Corps at 19, and he was probably about 22 when this was all going on. So, yeah, we were just kids, man.
That, but it, when you see them talk about their age and how they got to Vietnam, and that a lot of them had to have their parents sign up because they were under the age of 18 and had Marines in there. But the thing that strikes you is overwhelmingly how young these guys are. Okay, so that's one thing. Talk to me about one of the first scenes is Marines out on an OP, and one of them is recanting. One of them's recanting. He was awake, and they were just out on an OP, and all of a sudden the screen is dark can be. And all you hear is the sounds of night, crickets and things like that. And so talk to us about that scene and setting kind of the mood for that. And he almost gets stepped on, right? Or he does get stepped on by NVA soldiers.
Right, he got stepped on. That guy's named Steve Weiss, and Steve was he did 18 months. You know, he did a 13-month tour, and then he extended, and he came back to the siege. So, I mean, and he was, if he was on an LP, he was probably a fire team leader at the time. And I asked everybody that we interviewed what they remember about the beginning of the siege, and he told me that story, and I thought it was just a really interesting way to begin the film, because, you know, here we are, you know, it was common for us to go out on LPs and one or two guys would stay awake and the other two guys would go to sleep, because we never got enough sleep there. Right. And you never got enough sleep. And so, you know, he was out there probably thinking that everything was going to be fine, and it was dark, and all of a sudden he sees these guys coming, and I thought that was just intense and frightening, and how scary that was. And then they stepped on him, and he lived to tell about it. I just thought that was an amazing way to describe the entire experience at Quezon.
Getting got stepped on. I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. One of the guys who I think is one of the most interesting guys and kind of segues into a question about post-combat related mental health. Obviously, this has weighed on you in your life, and you wanted to make a documentary. And I don't know that I've ever asked you, what was your motivation? Was it to record your experience? Was it to... To tell the personal stories? What was your motivation in making it?
Well, I've always been trying to tell the story. I mean, I was unlike a lot of guys that were in Vietnam, and especially in Quezon, I didn't try to stuff it. You know, I came home, I wanted to talk to everybody about it, but you know how that was. Nobody was interested in talking about it.
Yeah, how did that work
so,
for you?
But I would wake up every morning and think about it. So, I mean, I thought this was an amazing story, and it was important that it gets told. We were at a reunion in Denver in 2009, and my wife, or a bunch of guys from Bravo Company there,
okay.
And we were sitting around telling our stories, and a lot of it she'd never heard anything about. It was like, so we're going home after, well, we're there, and she said, we gotta get these stories recorded. And I said, okay, and she said, what do I do? And I said, go tell the skipper you want to record the story of Bravo Company and see what he says. And he said, well, good luck. I'll back you, but good luck. He said. And so I didn't, you know, that was it to me. I much wasn't too hip on what was going on the way home. She told me we're going to make a film. And I don't know anything about filmmaking, and I never thought it would happen. But, you know, at first, we just wanted to record the story because we thought they were important.
Okay.
So that's why.
Okay. So as you go down the decision to record the story, one of the guys who I think I would say is the most intense guy in the documentary is a Marine named Frank McCauley.
Right.
He relives the battle towards the end in a trench in it seems like high definition, right? And so I'll use that as a segue. Opening up all these cans, what were your thoughts about going back there?
You know, it was more like I wasn't thinking a whole lot about all of that stuff. It was more like I was just trying to get the interviews.
Okay.
You know, it was procedural. You know, we contacted every Marine we knew that was with Bravo Company at that time and said, we want to make a film and we're going to go to San Antonio in 2010 and we're bringing a videographer with us and we want to interview you. And we had basically 9 guys show up there who wanted to talk. And Frank was one of them, although at the time he said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And so we went through it was 2 days it took us, and the first day right at the end, we were folding up all our gear, and then he told my wife, he said, okay, I'm ready. So he came in, and I mean, I had met him once. He was a new guy what we call the Ghost Patrol, the patrol of 30th March of 1968. And he was new. I mean, he was a brand new Marine there. I think he'd been there probably a couple of weeks. I didn't know him. He sat down, and I asked him a couple of questions, and man, it was amazing. I mean, it was absolutely amazing for me to sit there and watch him describe in such graphic detail what he remembered. It was just amazing to me. I mean, it was like, I'm watching him. We've talked about him a number of times since then, and I think you got it, man. He was there. At the moment he was describing that, he was right there.
So let me ask you, one of the other things that you noticed, and my guest this morning is he's a former Marine. What did you do professionally, Ken, in your like working life before you became a movie maker?
Oh, mostly I was a controller, an internal accountant kind of guy.
Okay.
So he's somebody to collect money.
He's a smart guy. He's a money guy. So Ken is making this documentary. One of the opening scenes, I think, is you must have a monitor because you're talking to them and all of a sudden, I think turn on videotape of the incoming barrage, and it must have had audio with it because your video, you can see the anxiety, the stress, and the intensity all change on these guys as you're talking to them, and it's incredible to watch them have a physical reaction to the sounds and the sights of Khe Sanh. What was that like for you? What was that like for you?
We didn't have anything like that.
What did you have?
Where was the camera operator and my wife, who was helping him and was taking still photos and me talking to him. That was it.
So what I'm seeing is just their reaction to the discussion.
Yep.
Okay. Because there's audio, there's incoming, like in the background. I didn't know if that was the ambient.
No, that's just a bunch of Marines back there raising hell. So we didn't have very good. I mean, it wasn't a great studio, and it wasn't a great you know, soundproof and all that stuff. We were just in a room next to all the rooms full of these Marines that were at this reunion that were yelling and, you know, having a good time. But we didn't have any sounds of caisson.
Okay. All right. There. So as you watch them, kind of open up about their experiences, and they range from guys getting, you know, I think a foot blown off to your corpsman. And I don't know how the corpsmen are ever right after something like this, because it's not like you happen to come upon people you don't know. These are your friends, right? These are guys you hang out with. These are guys you go drinking with. These are your buddies, and you're tending to them as they die. Now, most family members, if they're present when somebody dies in a hospital, it's a life-altering experience. It never changes them. I mean, so imagine a corpsman, an Army medic, is tending to traumatic gunshot shrapnel wounds of their friends as they die repeatedly. Those guys ought to be crazier than a loon. So as you're watching this, making this thing, what thoughts went through your head as you're watching these guys relive this stuff?
Well, you know, basically, I was just, you know, I was amazed. I was there. I mean, right. I was at caisson. And so I had my own notion of what that experience was like. And in some regards, all of these guys, we had similar things, but every one of them had a story that was completely different than mine that I had never heard before. And, you know, the doc was out there on the ghost patrol where all those guys got ambushed and killed, and he's out there taking care of his buddies, and he's getting shot, you know, and he crawled his way back. He crawled, and it took him all day to crawl back to the combat base by himself.
Okay, and let me just, the ghost
patrol. That's an amazing story to me.
The ghost patrol is a reinforced platoon that goes out on a patrol and gets ambushed by an estimated 2 battalions. And do you know how many guys survived that?
No.
Just a handful.
Probably about 15,
right.
You know, back.
Right. And so, and when you ask them, what's the date of that?
That is on March 25th. I mean, February 25th.
February 25th. So when you're talking to them, you know, and, you know, so he's taking them through this, you know, this event at caisson. And then all of a sudden you hear February 25th, and you just see them go still. Because you don't have to say anything more, do you, about what you're going to talk about, do you?
Right, right. I just asked them, what do you remember about the Ghost Patrol?
Right. And they... And there were guys that were guys that you interviewed that were on that ghost patrol, and then other guys that supported it and tried to be a QRF for it and things like that. And some of the stories are absolutely incredible in terms of stories of random chance and survival.
Right.
Well,
it was a terrible thing. You know, it was horrible. I mean, to this day, it's probably one of the most horrible days of my life, and I wasn't out there with them. I was in the perimeter, and we were watching it or listening to it. It was foggy that day, so it was horrible.
There's another patrol that goes out that gets caught between what, NVA fire, and then your own.
Yeah, we got caught up. We were going up a ridge, and we were supported by 50 calibers from behind us on the perimeter, and they shot into some of our guys. I watched them do that, and I was a radio man at that time for the platoon sergeant, and I was standing there, and I'm watching these guys get shot in the back. So, friendly fire.
Yeah. That's not so friendly. I will tell you this: it's just fascinating in terms of the what you see in the documentary relative to how vivid the experience still is, and the things that they tell you. You obviously had the, you know, you're obviously moving the kaleidoscope around your company. And did it surprise you the number of things that went on that you had no knowledge of?
Yeah, or that I did, you know, that I really didn't have knowledge of, you know.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'd heard about it, or I, you know, was aware of similar situations, but, you know, the intensity of it and the personal nature of the danger was, you know, like, I knew two of the guys in the movie fairly well in Vietnam. And then I knew the skipper, and I knew the two officers were somebody that you stayed away from. And the rest of those guys I didn't know. And so it was just real eye-opening to me what they experienced differently from me. So.
All right. My guest is the maker of a documentary called Bravo! Exclamation mark, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. And his name is Ken Rogers. Ken, as you then you take this stuff and you go home and you start going through it, did your view of the project change as you sat down and watched what you had and the power of what you had?
Yes, it did. It did. You know, I mean, I went home and I came home and then we went back out on the road. All of this happened in July of, we filmed these guys, nine of these guys in July of 2010.
Okay.
And then we went home with the intent of going back to Washington, D.C. because the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation had given us a little grant to get started, and they wanted us to go work with the Marine Corps History Division. So we were going to plan a trip to go back there, and we were going to get in the National Archives. And I got a phone call one day, and it was from Ann Horton, who was very ill. And he said, if you're coming, you better come now. And so we got in the car the next day, and we drove to Detroit area, and we interviewed him. And then we interviewed Cal Bright, who lived not too far away, and then we went to the National Archives and to the Marine Corps History Division and Marine Corps University and got all of this stuff, information,
right,
audio, a bunch of video stuff. On the way back, we interviewed three more guys, and then I sat on it for a long time because I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what to do. And we knew some film people here, and one of them said, well, you need to transcribe the interviews. So I sat down, and I would plug an interview into my DVD player, and I'd sit in front of my computer, and I would transcribe the interview into Word. And I had some help from the guy that we got to be our editor, who was a Vietnam vet, who worked for many, many years for Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas. And he told me, you know, put it in this format, and so that's when I suddenly understood what was there, was when I was typing these conversations into the computer. And instead of recording this story, then it became imperative that we finish this project and that those stories had to be honored on some level that I had not anticipated when I started out. The stories became really important to me and to my wife. I mean, it became, okay, now we need to get this stuff out there where people can see this, because it took a hell of a lot of guts for these guys to get in here and in front of a camera to expose themselves like that. These are Marines, man. We don't do that, you know. And so that's what it changed for me when I was doing that.
Interesting. All right, Ken, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to play a little bit of audio from just to give people a sense of the intensity. And I want you to, when we come back, I want to set up that battle in the trench line, and then I want to play some of the audio And I've got a couple email questions for you. So my guest this morning is Ken Rogers. The documentary is called Bravo, Uncommon Men, or Common Men, Uncommon Valor. It's about Bravo Company 126 at Quezon. It is an incredible piece of history, for anybody who's been, to war. It is an incredible look at these guys and what they've lived with for all these years. And I think if you want to learn lessons about being gentle with yourself, if you want to learn lessons about how to live with it and how to cope with it, there are tons of them in this about each one of these guys. Before there was a PTSD diagnosis, before there was anybody helping anybody, these guys were living with it. They were living with it caisson size, okay? Caisson size, which is not, you know, the small version of those kind of events. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue with my guest today, and that is former Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps, Mr. Ken Rogers. So more of that coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good,
are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Listen up, employers. Veterans can be a great asset to your company or organization. Veterans have gained skills in leadership, teamwork, and performance under pressure. Veterans have received the very best training in their fields and are never afraid to tackle a tough situation to accomplish the mission. If you are looking to hire a veteran, the Department of Labor can help you make it happen. You hire a veteran today, you won't be sorry.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
For America's wounded warriors, sometimes coming home can be a battle in itself. Every one of them needs our support to meet the challenges they face every day. The USO provides Americans a way to offer that support to our wounded warriors and their families. Join us. Visit USO.org to learn how you can make a difference in their lives by donating today. The USO.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life. The Global Soft Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global Soft website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's 8:48 here on a Monday morning. I'm remiss in not asking, Ken. Did you watch the Super Bowl last night, Ken?
No, I did not.
Oh, that's right. You were busy. First of all, happy anniversary and congratulations.
Well, thank you. But, you know, I don't watch much professional sports anymore. Too much money in it, man. It's just these guys all are... You know, too many of them, not all of them. Some of them are great guys, I'm sure, but yeah. Just too much.
No, you're not alone in that. A lot of people have been turned off by the money and don't watch it. But it was, I'll tell you what, it was an incredible performance last night as New England got down by 25 points and came back and tied it and then won it overtime. So
yeah, I saw that. In the news this morning. So.
Yeah, no, it was a very dramatic theater. Now, I want to play some audio from the documentary, and you're going to get a sense. This is what's McCauley's first name again?
Frank
McCauley, right? So you're going to hear just I want
to. We've got two McCauleys in this. Frank. There's Mike and there's Frank, but I'm sure it's Frank. So,
okay. All right. So here's Frank McCauley.
The other. I mean, he was soaked in it, and he had two radios.
This isn't him.
He was talking to the air on one radio, and he was talking to the artillery on the other radio. And here, all his best friends are laying right here, dead at his feet, and this guy's still taking care of business.
I finally met up with my machine gun guy. I was supposed to be the eighth.
Okay, now this is McCauley. This is just a sample. Listen to the intensity and how vivid it is.
Gunner to him, and he finally came in the hole, and then this other tall corporal came in, and he decides that the reason everyone around us is dying is because there's a machine gun nest over there, and it's like 150 feet away, and it's nothing but more than a big sandbag with a tiny slit in it, and they're ripping on us. And so he says, come on, it's our job. We got to knock it out. Well, I've seen enough war movies to realize.
Now, I want to ask you a question. I want to play some more. He's talking to you, right? And there's a black background. He's got his eyes closed for part of the time. He's looking up, and he's not really making eye contact with you. As you sat there and did this, is this one of those moments, Ken, when you were like, he is there? He's in that trench line.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like, you know, most of the guys came in there and they were, how would I say it, somewhat reluctant to get into the details, I think. Not all of them, but some of them. But he wasn't. I mean, he just got right into it. And, you know, the sound John Nutt, who's our editor, primarily in his career was a sound man who worked on Apocalypse Now and Amadeus and a bunch of really great films in the sound department and won some awards for his work. And so when he was working on a film, we told him, you know, you're a sound guy, use sound. And he did that. I mean, that's his work. He got those. He asked me for some sounds, and I got him some sounds, and that's.
Yeah, they're, you know, real.
He put those in there.
Yeah, they're real.
Is that real?
Is that why you told me have a good sound system and turn it up?
Yeah, yeah. Because we told him, you know, go ahead and use that sound, and you should have seen his face when he told him that. I have something he doesn't hear too often from directors, I'm sure, is let her rip.
No, but I'll tell you what, these explosions go on throughout the whole thing. And about halfway through, you know, my dog's under the bed, and you're like, hey, would you stop this shit? All right, okay, we got the message, all right? But it just keeps going and going, and you're subjected to it for, how long is the documentary? 90 minutes or so?
118 minutes.
118 minutes. So 118 minutes, 77 days they lived through this shit. All right, let me play more of. And so Macaulay is looking where I froze it. He's looking almost towards the ceiling as he's reliving this fight in this trench line.
The first wave, on a machine gun, yes, doesn't make it. So anyway, he goes, "Come on, let's go!" And he's actually trying to drag me and the machine gunner out of that hole and head for that spot. Fine, okay, that's cool. Well, okay, we will do it because that's kind of what we're supposed to be doing. But I want to just see.
And he has these asides as he's telling you this, where he's talking about like how he's rationalizing it, or you know, one of the first things he says is that, yeah, you know, I really didn't want to use my rifle, I'm not a violent guy, and yet he's had Kaysan and he's in this trench line. So it's so it's such an incredible window into this dynamic event that doesn't diminish over time if you open the door to it. Just incredible. Right. Just incredible. Let me play a few more seconds of it.
What we were doing, I mean, I didn't want to go out of that whole blind. So I took a peek, and I could see the sandbag, and I could see where it was at. And I said, okay. And so anyway, I did my clip, put a new clip in, and I looked at the dirt in front of me on that bowl, and I thought, that's cool. That's the last thing I'm going to see. I'm going to fall right face down in that shit when I can leave this hole. And so we charged out of there, all three of us. And I was the middle, and the machine gunner was here, and the knucklehead here, third of the way there. He spun, got hit, and left us. But I put every round, all 20 rounds, dead center through that little teeny-weeny slit. And the machine gunner, he was chewing up those sandbags, and we made it. We made it. We made it to there and jumped over the sandbags, and there's this big sandbag pit and two dead gooks, and of course the guy with the machine gun, he's kind of, his adrenaline's flowing. So he just blasts them anyway.
The platoon commander, Lieutenant Dillon.
That's just maybe a minute of him and them describing the action in that trench. And I have to tell you, Ken, it is an incredible, incredible journey with you guys at Kaysan. I was blown away by it.
It's intense, and it's personal, and it's emotional, and it gets you at the emotional level, which I think is where it gets so effective, because this isn't something you're reading in a history book or watching one of those documentaries where, you know, they're playing some kind of boring music and there's a voiceover describing what's happening. This is, you know, it's an emulation of somewhat what it was like. You know, that's what the movie is. That, you know, I'm a storyteller, man. I mean, and if you're a storyteller, it's about images and action. And we tried to put that in this film, and I think it really, much more than I ever imagined, I think that we really got it.
Okay, and I want to talk to you about that now. So you have this thing, and you're it's beginning to come together as you're watching this creation of yours. As you're nearing towards the end, this thing has changed from just a series of, you know, we're gonna record this and do interviews. This has now become an intense emotional experience. As you got towards the end of it, how did it change then? Because it had to become a much more special project towards the end than it was when you started.
Well, it just became, you know, I'm a loyal person, so if I start out to do something with somebody, I usually try to stick with it through thick and thin. So I was pretty much committed to wherever it was going to take us. But, you know, we got the interviews, and then we got it to the editor, and he took, you know, and I gave him the layout. Here's how the movie's going to work. And he made a six-hour film of just interviews, and I went down to California where he lives, and we watched it, and I couldn't believe. Right then, it was like, wow, this thing is much bigger than I ever thought it was going to be.
Great.
This is, and he was so blown away. And this guy's been in the business for years, and he just couldn't believe these interviews. And so then he put the music to it, and we went through a couple of cuts, and then he sent, you know, when we got the cuts, and I was watching this thing about 10 or 15 times a day trying to come up with the final cut. And, you know, I couldn't sleep at night. I was having nightmares. You know, I'm in the trench line, and it's dark, and people are snaking around, and they're going to kill me. And so, I mean, it was traumatic for me through the summer of 2011 until we finally got to the end, and there was a reunion in Rochester, Minnesota, of the Case on Veterans, and so I told everybody that was in the film, we were done, and we want to show it to you first, because I wanted to see what they thought.
Right.
And so most of them showed up, and we showed the film, and they were just, you know, I mean, it was very emotional and powerful event for me to screen this film, because I knew I had it.
Right.
I knew it was right. And so then it became this dogged chore to get it out there so people will watch it, because this is a story about a bunch of guys, a bunch of kids, but it's about a lot more. It's about, you know, savagery and the human ability to endure so much and still have some principles in some regard.
I think that's what comes through to me so much. Is that you meet these guys as gentlemen, you know, in some in suits, some in shirts, and Frank McCauley comes in a t-shirt. The most, you know, the scene that I just played you some audio. He's sitting there in a t-shirt that says something about San Antonio on it, but it's these guys went on with their lives, and they weren't victims of it. They dealt with it. They've learned to live with it. But it's an incredible, incredible statement about the strength of you guys as men. And again, there was no PTSD diagnosis. It was just come home and go back to work and get on with your life. And incredible, incredible, incredible.
Well, it wasn't easy. And, you know, some of us, I think it was easier than for others, obviously. A lot of guys that were a number of guys that were a case on during the siege committed suicide, some of them not long after, some of them are in the pen, one of them was executed in California, I think in 1998,
wow.
You know, it was tough, it was tough for me for 20 years after I got out, it was really hard on me, but what are you going to do? I mean, you can't quit, because nobody cares, I mean, they really don't. If you don't take care of yourself, you know, your family cares about you, hopefully, but, you know, it's on you. It's on you.
It's on you. You know, that's a great, I love that line, it's on you. An email, and then I'll let you go, and I certainly appreciate your time. My guest this morning, Ken Rogers, Marine, Quezon veteran, Vietnam veteran, and documentary filmmaker now. Mac, I'm curious, what is the greatest impact that Ken has had from making this? Greatest impact on you?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer, and I think it probably changes every day. You know, the thing that really the really big impact on me is the power of story.
Right.
And the power of what story can do if you tell it. Those guys that sat down in that room in San Antonio basically had never talked about this stuff to anybody. And they got up and they had the guts to tell that story. And in the case of one guy, he said, now I've done that and I can get on with my life.
Oh.
You know, so the ability to articulate what has happened to you to an audience, I think, has possibilities to be very, you know, to offer you a lot of relief. If you got some kind of monster like the Siege of Quezon sitting on your shoulder.
And you know what? And a lot of guys have them, too. They're their own monsters.
Oh, yeah.
And, all right. Ken, one more email. Mac, wow, I was sitting here listening to the audio, and I stopped work with my little headset on because of the intensity of the audio. Where do I get a copy? Sir?
www.bravotheproject.com.
There you go. Bravotheproject.com. Ken, I can't say, I think, you know, I've watched it now two times, and after hearing it again, I want to watch it again. But I just want to compliment you on, the tribute to what you guys did there, and also for all the rest of us. It's a great example of how you guys have dealt with it. And one of the things you see is you see guys in various degrees of dealing with it in the documentary, which I think holds out a great illustration for us, is that there is no one way, that everybody makes sense of it in their own way. Ken himself talks about, you know, his feelings of going what he thought was insane at Quezon, and the click of a camera pulled him back to one side. And so I think it's a great tool for people that struggle with post combat related mental health in terms of, you know, finding your way. And so I, first of all, my compliments again on the quality of work that you did, and you and your wife, and congratulations on your anniversary. Thank you very much for doing this, and I hope you don't mind if I continue to bother you.
Well, that's okay. I enjoy it a lot. Love talking to you, man.
All right, bud. Cool. Well, no, thank you again. Thanks for coming on this morning. I love having you on, and I love talking about the documentary, and I'm a fan, so well done.
Okay, so every time you watch it...
You're coming on.
No, every time you watch it, though, if something new will pop up to give you some thought. That's, to me, the real...
beauty of it.
...great thing about that film is it just keeps...
giving.
Keeps revealing things about human nature.
Right.
That are... you know, profound in many ways. So, anyway, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. You have a great day, sir.
All right. Thanks, Ken. That is Ken Rogers. We are going to take a quick break. The Gunner joins us here in 4 minutes on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.